Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:06 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is March 16th. The Federal Reserve over the weekend introduced a number of really rather extraordinary measures. I think the most important takeaway is that they were propelled into action, not necessarily because of the coronavirus specifically, but because of the liquidity conditions that are emerging on a global basis. And like it or not, the Federal Reserve is the central banker to the world. So they've reopened swap lines with a range of other central banks. They have cut the reserve requirement on banks to zero. That's a carte blanche for banks to get out there and start lending. And they don't have to hold anything in reserve. It really means that there is clearly a liquidity crunch, either underway or about to hit, that is epic in proportions. Well, of course, we know what that is. With lockdowns underway in a number of countries and a number of other countries, including the UK and the USA, moving progressively closer to a full lockdown scenario, then there is obviously the threat of a major liquidity crisis. It means that the Federal Reserve is going to have to extend massive amounts of credit to the financial sector. That is going to occur through quantitative easing and through direct repo actions. The quantity of money that is being considered is epic in proportion, and we haven't even begun to see it yet. So, for example, the S&P 500 is down about 300 points on the close. If we look at it intraday, it had attempted to rally, but the rally petered out throughout the day. The NASDAQ 100 was also spent most of the day, in fact, well up on off the lows, but it collapsed in the last half hour of trading, and in fact closed on the low of the day. So what I find particularly interesting right now is that a lot of the conventional ways of looking at the market are sending buy signals. When, for example, we look at the number of shares that are trading above their 200-day moving average on the NYSE, it's down to 6.81%. Now, when we start to scale that out and look where was the low back in the period from October 2008 to March 2009, or September 2009, it was all the way down in the 1.5% level. So we're at extraordinary levels right now. But one thing that I think is important is that there were an awful lot of shares that were in the region of their 200-day moving averages. So they could have bounced. There was approximately half of all the market was in the region of its 200-day moving average less than 2 weeks ago. And now most of those shares have just broken down. That suggests that we are still in a point where there is room for additional volatility. And the VIX index is pushing right up into the 80 region. Now, when we look at this on a longer term basis and simply on a closing basis, well, we can go back and look at what happened in 2008, but it's important to realize that the market was not closing at these levels back then. So this is an extraordinary set of circumstances. If we then look at the candle chart and just zoom in for the decade, we can see that we did get up to these levels in 2008. The peak of volatility was around 90, but we didn't close up there. And I think that's the most important point. The kind of volatility that we're getting now is extraordinary. Now, this is raising the clear potential that they're simply going to shut the stock market. And that, I think, is potentially one of the extraordinary measures that is rational to consider. The panic that is ensuing and the destruction of wealth that is going on in response to what is in likelihood going to be a multi-month, but perhaps not multi-quarter problem, does justify closing down the stock market, and while the market is shut, go into a full lockdown. The, I think, primary way to get control of this panicky environment would be simply to, of course, there's nothing simple about it. It would be to shut the stock market and delay all debt payments. Give everybody a holiday in terms of their debt payments. Ensure that Social Security benefits are paid. Allow people who are employed in the services sector to receive a stipend relative to the quantity of money that they're no longer paying. Try and encourage landowners and landlords to give rental holidays in return for the fact that there are going to be no debt repayments. Do all of that while you're doing a lockdown. Ensure everybody is locked down. Kill this virus off in a very swift period of time. Ensure that once the market reopens and the debt markets reopen, that we are back on a growth footing. Now, of course, these are extraordinary measures, but the stock market is pulling back in a violent manner. And these are the kinds of things that are now being considered. Well, what that does also represent is a threat to short positions. What we're also starting to see is that short positions are being rolled out. But bans on short positions are being rolled out almost faster. That is primarily starting in Europe, but it is possible that it is going to extend to other areas as well. There is no doubt that we're going to have an economic impact. Living in Los Angeles, all restaurants have been closed, all gyms, all schools have been closed, and that obviously is going to have an economic impact. It hasn't been felt yet because it only started last night, but it is going to probably be extended to other cities as well. When the two largest cities in the USA announce a partial lockdown, other cities will follow. I now know somebody who has contracted the coronavirus personally. So what that is also telling us is that the number of cases is increasing, testing is increasing, but it is getting progressively closer to individuals. I think it is not so far from now that we're all going to know somebody who has been affected directly by the coronavirus. Well, this particular individual is in his 50s and is currently running a temperature of 103. He was on a ski trip, and all 10 people that were on the ski trip have been infected. And that is obviously something that everybody needs to be aware of, that there is a very clear risk of that there is going to be an additional rise in infections. So this is a significant issue, that a lot of the people who get sick are going to have mild symptoms, but there is going to be a significant number of people who experience severe symptoms or acute symptoms, and then there are going to be a large number relative to the number of beds available that experience severe symptoms. So these are, I think, important points. It does suggest that we are likely to see a further contraction in terms of the action. Now, I think there are two important charts that are really worth considering. Now, I'm simply going back into my archive of charts that I've been building up over the last few years. I was looking at lots of them over the weekend, but two really jumped out to me. It was something that people were talking about in April of last year, was the reliance of this bull market on buybacks and non-financial corporates buying back their own shares, was one of the most significant sources of demand all the way through from 2009 until now. Institutions were net sellers and households were just starting to buy. Now, there are two important points that I think are worth considering here. The first is that companies buying back their own shares tends to be a very pro-cyclical event. I created a spreadsheet today, and looking at all the buyback data I could find, I'll post it in comment of the day today. Well, Welltower, for example, was the average price it paid for its shares. They must have gone through a stock split, but it's had an extraordinary pullback. At the other end of the scale, and of course, Welltower is a retirement home REIT. So obviously that is where a lot of the shorting activity has taken place. There are also a considerable number of companies that do not buy back their own shares. But this is for the S&P 500. In other words, it is interesting that exactly 400 of them have been buying back their shares and 100 have not. Some of the big companies that do not buy back their own shares include Verizon or Berkshire Hathaway or Danaher, for example. But then we also have a number of the big companies like Google and Amazon and Facebook do not buy back their own shares. Well, I think this is an important point, because when we look at the kind of cash crunch that is going on right now, well, we have to consider that companies are probably going to cut the buyback program before they cut their dividend. We have seen that banks are going to be significantly cash impaired. With the contraction in the short-term interest rate, banks now have no ability to make money. They are going to be under extraordinary stress as a result. Reducing the reserve requirement is rather beside the point. If they are making loans and making no money off those loans, what's the point in making the loans? At the same time, they are going to have to hold reserves in order to compensate for the potential for defaults to rise. We've seen that a number of private equity firms, a number of private companies and listed companies have been tapping on their credit lines. And they're hoarding cash now. So that's a good thing. They're hoarding cash right away. But how long is that cash going to last if there's no money coming in? That is the big question. When we look at, for example, some of the companies that IPO'd, that's the wrong chart, I apologize, in the last year, and I don't believe I have that chart any longer. One thing that did certainly pop out to me was the number of company or the amount of earnings in the S&P 500 that rely on the five big FANG shares, the mega caps. They have been the drivers of EPS growth over the last decade, and they've been relative strength performers over the course of this pullback so far. But I think what's underappreciated, and it represents a certainly a threat that is, I think, not being discussed at all, is how much their earnings rely on loss-making smaller companies buying their cloud products. That, I think, is something that is really quite important. Amazon, for example, was up approximately $100 at one point today, but gave up almost all. Well, in fact, it did. It gave up all of the initial advance and closed down about $100. Well, when we think about what are the opportunities, well, obviously, a lot more people are going to be at home and they're going to be ordering online. And most particularly, they'll be all ordering groceries online. So that's a positive for Amazon. But that's a loss-making business for Amazon. And they are pretty marginal on the supply of dry goods via their delivery services. Where they make their profit is from web services. But web services is heavily reliant on a lot of those loss-making companies. That does represent an existential threat to some of these bigger companies. So that's one of the points about that chart of where demand has been coming from. But then when we think about, there were a number of articles coming out in January of this year talking about the return of the retail investor. And I believe this is relevant now because over the course of the weekend, I had, I think, three different conversations with people I would consider to be retail investors who all used Friday as a buy the dip opportunity. One young chap, and the other point is that every one of those people used the Robinhood app to buy their shares. Now, there's a couple of unique attributes about Robinhood. The first is that their system completely froze up on three separate occasions last week, and yet people are still willing to trade via the platform. You can buy as many as just one share, and there are no commissions. So it's hard to imagine exactly how they're making money. So they must be making it on the spread. But the other point is that in the course of a bull market, retail investors are conditioned to buy the dip, and they will keep on buying the dip until they have taken significant losses. At the other end of the scale, there are going to be institutional investors who have just taken a significant drawdown, and there is a clear temptation to think, well, we can have an emergency meeting, and some people will think this is a buying opportunity, some will say it's a top, people will say, I just don't know, so they stop buying. Well, the retail investors can support a short-term rebound, but if institutional investors stop buying, then that contributes to top formation development. So these are important considerations. Now, the other, I think, important chart that really stood out to me, and this one was from March of last year. It was the number of mortgage holders in the USA where they spend more than half their income on their mortgage or their federal home mortgage. And it was coming up to peaks in excess of 2008 and approximately 23% of borrowers. At the same time, the credit quality of those borrowers has been deteriorating. Well, it's all well and good to say that I work from home so I can spend 2 weeks inside and really not have any ill effects. But for people who are living paycheck to paycheck, then missing a few paychecks in a row because the restaurant they work at has been closed, well, that's obviously a very different scenario. So these are, I think, some of the most important considerations that if we do get a closing down of economic activity, it is going to hit the most vulnerable parts of society hardest. And that, I think, is also likely to require extraordinary measures to combat. So those are, I think, some of the threats that are arising. What we also saw in here today was that a number of the precious metals pulled back in an extremely violent manner, but gold shares rallied pretty spectacularly, up nearly 15%. We have not seen gold shares trading at these levels since early 2016, and they didn't stay there for all that long. They retraced almost all of the decline we saw last week. But when we zoom in on the short term, well, it pretty much unwound all of the decline we put in on Friday. I think it is a reasonable chance that we're at the bottom for the gold shares for the simple reason that if we're going to think about a stock market sector that is likely to surprise on the upside for first quarter earnings when they're reported in April, well, gold shares have got to be a leading contender. When we think about the gold price, it did briefly pull back below the $15 level and then came right back up, excuse me, $1,500 level, came right back up to test the region of the trend mean. And I think that there is potential here that we're going to see some additional consolidation. Silver was down almost $3 at one point in here today, and then recouped part of that decline. This kind of acceleration is really a massive standout. It is obviously a factor in clear contagion selling. And contagion selling in assets that would normally benefit from money printing is, I think, creates a value opportunity. The simple fact of the matter is that all of the efforts underway right now to stimulate economic activity are only going to devalue currencies. There is obviously there are a number of different aims, but the clear conclusion is that they're going to devalue their currencies. The platinum price was trading at over $1,000 for a brief period back in January, and at the low in here today, it got down to approximately $560. So it has effectively halved this year, and this is an extraordinary acceleration on the downside, and I do think it looks really rather climactic. The palladium price has also halved in the space of approximately 2 weeks, and coming down from approximately 2,700 to 14, and or in fact just below 14 earlier on today, is a really incredible retracement of the advance we had in 2019. But it almost certainly represents a trend ending relative to the accelerated trend we'd seen earlier on. So there is obviously now a very clear bearish look to this chart, whereas the kinds of moves we've seen in the other precious metals look increasingly like bottoming characteristics. When we look at what central banks are doing, they are providing every form of assistance that they can think of. It is now on governments to provide all of the assistance that they can think of. The hit to economic activity from the coronavirus is obviously something that is rapidly getting priced into markets. When we think about how is all of this going to play out, the big question really is about leverage ratios. It's about the reliance of the market on buybacks, and how well will companies be able to continue to buy back their shares when they are not taking money in. That is likely to have a deleterious effect on leverage. When we then think about the government bond market, the 10-year Treasury yield was in fact down a little in here today, but it was well off the lows. One thing that has been observable during other periods of quantitative easing is yields have risen rather than contracted. The kind of activity that we've had over the course of the last 10 days in the bond markets is supportive of the view that we've had a meaningful low around the 50 basis point level. That virtually ensures that we're going to have a steeper yield curve. That is what the Federal Reserve is trying to engineer. The problem is that when you start getting a steeper yield curve after an inverted yield curve, you are very likely to have a recession, and that's what the market is pricing in. One of the major points that people like Ray Dalio and Jeff Gundlach and Paul Tudor Jones have been highlighting over the course of last year was the zero bound being an important point where pushing on a string becomes a significant issue, that the amount of assistance that is provided to the market may not be effective, and that it could result in yields rising. Well, we are potentially now at a similar condition, and these are, I think, important considerations, because the stock market now increasingly looks like we are going to get a further correction, and that we are seeing, and well, let's just simply look at the chart, that we've had a very stiff pullback. The S&P 500 now is trading significantly below the 1,000-day moving average. This is about the biggest inconsistency one might ever see in the context of a major bull market. It has now closed in the region of the low from back in 2018, but having broken below the 1,000-day moving average, we have to conclude that the 10-year bull market is over, that the uptrend has been broken, and that we might have a short-term oversold condition, but expecting the bull market to be to reassume is, I think, something that we cannot hope for in the short term. What we need to see is clear evidence of bottoming activity. Now, the acceleration on the downside, we've had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. We are still getting the contagion selling, so it can still continue to accelerate on the downside. A large upside or upward dynamic sustained for more than a week is going to be at the absolute minimum to indicate that we are back in a bottoming phase. So far, we're still in the declining phase. There is then we have to look at what's happening in terms of currencies. The euro in here today was a little bit steadier, so we're not getting as much dollar strength. The strength in the euro over the course of the last, or really from the end of February all the way through until the first week of March, was really more about closing carry trades than any other factor. The pullback in the dollar over the course of the last week was more about the raising of cash because both bonds and equities were falling together. Today, what the market is looking at is the clear willingness of the US to devalue the currency in service to trying to protect the domestic economy. There is obviously going to be some competition on that front because Europe has got equal, if not greater, challenges to overcome, and we have not yet seen the size of the stimulative measures that the ECB is willing to engage in. This is a very big test for Christine Lagarde on that front. The Nifty index was also in negative territory in here today, and it is likely to be in additional negative territory tomorrow. The number of cases continues to rise in India, and their ability to deal with this crisis is going to be inhibited by their underdeveloped medical care system. The Chinese market was also in negative territory in here today, probably now starting to respond more to global factors than domestic factors. But so far, it has continued to remain a really quite steady market relative to the kind of volatility we're seeing everywhere else. The Australian market was also in negative territory in here today. It has pulled back violently over the course of this month, and it is still pretty close to its lows. When we look at the continuous commodity index, it has continued to extend its downtrend. It is now below the lows put in 2015, and significantly now coming back into the region of the lows from 2008. But unfortunately, it doesn't look nearly as overextended on the downside on this occasion as it did back in 2008. So the I think the risk here is that we're going to see additional downside from the commodity complex because of the hiatus in economic activity. Oil prices were down over $4 in here today and closing on a new low. This is likely to be stimulative for the global market, but it takes time for low energy prices to have a meaningful effect in terms of stimulus. They accrue on a month-by-month basis. But we are coming back down towards the lows put in back in early 2016. This will result in some of the supply getting locked in. But the only way it's going to get locked in is through the fact that a number of the high yield energy providers in the USA are going to go bust. And the energy sector is now trading, the high yield energy sector is trading at 1600 basis points over treasuries. The one thing that I'm rather cautious of is that investors are very willing to anticipate that we are already at a buying opportunity, that retail investors have already been buying the dip, and high yield is coming back towards the peaks. Generally, the high yield sector is coming back towards the peaks from 2011 and 2016. So there is the potential that high yield spreads will be contained around 800 basis points, in which case they will represent a buying opportunity. And we certainly know that the pullbacks we're seeing on the wider market are very alarming. If this virus is contained in the next couple of months, then I think people might be convinced that it was all just a short-term shock. I spent most of the day tuned in to Singularity University's coronavirus webinar. They had a lot of technical difficulties, but they have 20,000 people logged on listening to what they have to say. I think one of the most important points they made was that Roche announced over the weekend that they have developed a test for the coronavirus that they anticipate being able to produce millions of within the month, and over the next few months additional millions, and that it has results within 3 hours. Well, that's a very encouraging development. And we also know that Moderna has started its vaccine trial today, with the first patient being treated in here today. So that share was in positive territory this morning. If they can demonstrate that their vaccine is effective, well, then there's the potential that we can start rolling that out, and that the economic impact from this virus is going to be moderate. One thing we certainly know is that the attention of the world is now very firmly focused on finding a solution. There is the clear potential that a solution will be found, that the worst case scenario over the course of the next few years is that we will probably need to get both a coronavirus and flu shot to avoid a seasonal outbreak. And I think that is potentially the worst case scenario over the medium term. The short term remains under pressure. The impact that's going to have on the debt cycle is also something that is really quite acute. I think the most important point to bear in mind is that everything that people were worried about last year, whether it was over leverage, whether it was the reliance on buybacks, whether it was the tendency of governments to rely on printing, or the large deficits that governments are running, the failure of many central banks to get off the zero bound because or over the last decade, the extraordinarily high prices for property in places like Australia and Hong Kong and Canada, and the bubble that's evolved in the private equity sector, most particularly in venture capital. All of these were considered risks a year ago. They are now clear and present dangers as a result of the economic hiatus that is a result of the coronavirus. So those are significant issues. When we think about what the potential solutions are, well, one is time. One is a very aggressive social distancing program and aggressive testing of just about everyone on a repeated basis. But then we also need to have some kind of fiscal response. And it is really going to be about breaking the rules if we're going to get a swift resolution and really bail out some of the most vulnerable parts of society, which is going to be necessary. Either that, or we're going to have a longer recession. I think a shallow recession is already baked in now to the market. The bigger question is whether it is going to be a deeper recession. That is the much bigger question, and we don't yet have an answer to it. So we're still seeing markets come under pressure, and there's no sign yet that the selling is in fact over. But what we are starting to see is bottoming activity in the precious metals sector. And of course, they should benefit in an environment where there is going to be a wall of money hitting the market. I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.
To know. Well, we've got some questions that have come in from the audience. I'm going to have you work with my team to get some of those, the right ones answered, either through social or as a post later on, so we'll be in touch with you. But thank you so much for joining us and giving all of us us your time today.
Thank you. I'm learning a lot.
All right. Well, we'll probably see you out on social and maybe have you back for another session in the future.
I don't use those.
Just kidding. Then maybe we'll share on your behalf to our social channel so that people can see it. We'll figure it out either way.
Bye.
All right. Have a good one. See ya.
Yep.
All right, everybody. That concludes our sixth session of the day. I saw some stuff come through in the questions, so let me respond to those quickly before we wrap this one up. I want to confirm a couple of the URLs. Slides right here. Let's see what happens when I click this button. Oh, that happens. That's better. All right, we'll do this moving forwards. So Nell slides. I've tested this link multiple times. If you're still looking for Nell slides, they are here and has been vetted by folks. So use this URL right here. All sessions are recorded. They'll be around indefinitely, either on Crowdcast or on our own website. Some folks have asked about subtitles. We've been streaming live to YouTube. However, we ran into some issues with their API. So keep checking YouTube. Usually you can add subtitles to the presentations there on the live stream. For those of you where English is not your primary language, we apologize for that inconvenience. This was the best we were able to do given the timing. If anybody is interested in translating stuff, by all means, please feel free to reach out to us by joining the chat down here. It's a WhatsApp group. It's a great place to ask questions along the way or just post comments about what's going on. Last thing that I'll note here is that there's some of these questions that I'm purposely not responding to because we're going to cover a lot of these things coming forward. And Amory might not be the best person, or Nell maybe wasn't the best person, so I promise that I'm looking through all these questions and looking for opportunities as much as possible.
Hey, Philip, it's Owen. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing alright. How are you doing today?
Oh, well, you know, let's just call it busy. Yeah, a little bit of an understatement.
I will shut this one down, and we will see you in Raymond McCulley's session, where we're going to be talking about learning some more about our DNA and how we might be able to go about curing some of these diseases. So, we'll see you shortly.
I did. I guess, if I want to just create an LLC, because I talked with your dad, and I'm maybe not understanding everything perfectly. So, if we set up the LLC in Nevada Trust Company and have a custodial account, that will serve as the account. But I guess this is going to be my primary source of income, so I'll just need to. It'll be rooted in there and then root back out again, I guess, would be the main use of it.
Okay, this will be important project or in general?
Specific project. Yeah, I guess, for example, I've got, I'm basically keep my pension in TD Ameritrade. I keep my pounds in England. I keep my, because I still have money from Fuller Money, but it's not a lot, so I just leave it there. Someday the pound might go back up. So then I might change it.
I'm not laughing at you, but I'm just getting
But I guess, this new job I'm taking will be my primary source of dollar income. So I'll be needing that to pay my living expenses.
Okay.
used to be account really necessary, or how does it work? Like, what is the purpose of it? I don't understand that. Yeah, I'm going to be working with a marketing company in Florida and Breitbart. So I'll be writing a newsletter with Breitbart. It's actually the reason I have to have an LLC is because of the bloody California freelancers rule. So I can't just tell them, I can't just give them my name as a sole prop anymore. I need to have an LLC. If I have the LLC in California, I got to pay the $800 a month or a year for the LLC tax. I was thinking, well, would it be better to set it up in Nevada? Yes, kind of, yeah. I mean, I am currently working with one of the affiliates from Florida in the UK. I'll have to stop doing that. So that money is coming directly to me in California. So then, of course, I pay city tax on top of that as well. Well, the CPA said just go ahead and create an LLC, and I said, well, I can do it in Nevada, and they said, well, yeah, you can do it in Nevada, but you're still going to have to pay California taxes because you're a resident here. I guess I was just trying to avoid having to pay bloody California another tax just because I don't want to be classed, or because they're forcing me not no longer classified as a sole prop. I kind of understand that because it's a pass-through entity, so like there's no getting around that. If I'm resident in California, I gotta pay California tax. I think that's unavoidable. Okay, so it's going to cost me $350 dollars a year, and sure, yeah, that's fine. And then when the custodial account is set up, how do I access that? How do, like, is it online, or do I have to call you guys, or what goes on? I think that's probably the best thing to do, is just set up a bank account. So does that bank account need to be in Nevada, if it's a Nevada LLC?
It can be anywhere.
Okay.
No.
Okay, well, I think that's probably the best thing to do. That's probably the best thing to do, is I'll just set up a bank account, because I can get Chase to just create another business account for me, and then I can route money around easily online without having to, you know, to kind of engage with lots of communication. I started working for them last night, so today it is. this form you sent me, it's a custody agreement, a W-9 form, investor account form, fee schedule, proxy voting disclosure.
Hello, everybody.
So what should I sign? Should I do
the
W-9 as well?
Raymond McCulley, one of our faculty members here at Singularity University.
Okay. And then I'll just
he's the principal of Exponential Biosciences,
set up the,
founding faculty
the,
and chair of digital biology at Singularity.
Nevada Trust, managing trust and
he's
investments
also the
form as well.
Of BioCurious, which is the world's first biohacker space. He's been doing some really cool stuff lately with genetics around COVID-19.
Yeah, it's like all the blue bits I can fill in online
and
then print.
A lot of the research and efforts that are underway right now. So thank you for being here with us today. I'm excited for you to take us on a journey.
It's a huge pleasure. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yep.
Nice piece for me was in the office pool for Armageddon. I had the little square that was marked, a bat sneezes on a pangolin and starts a global pandemic. So I've really made out. And I want to be clear, I'm not trying to make light inappropriately of the situation. I get that it's a very big deal and it's going to continue to get to be a bigger deal. But I hope that we can also find good things to look at and laugh as we go
through. Just fill the whole thing out and then you can decide.
I want to go ahead and tell you a little bit about what we're going to look at today. So this is my presentation, and this is what we titled it, which is DNA Beats Rock, Paper, Scissors, and Coronavirus 2. And then the rather immodest subtitle, Genomic Supremacy in the Last